Welcome back, Red Arc Warriors podcast, Redux, Redo. We are redoing some that I lost on the Red Arc Warriors podcast because it turns out technology crashes sometimes. This is the podcast for those who want to learn about rhetoric and how to straighten out the world with words, the bent words, the boomerang words. We're making them all javelins. We're going to make everything nice and straight and clear in rhetoric world. I'm Dr. Dan French. Rhetorician, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, have a new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion, all the different softwares you need to oscillate through in order to win with every single human being. That's the offer. The podcast, we talk to comedians about their politics, always crazy and fun, and I let them do uncensored bits here because they're afraid to talk in clubs anymore. It's too much trouble. I talk to extreme political viewpoints, or at least people that are far away from me, which typically is the right, because I'm a comedian. I want people to be relaxed. And I do conversions on that. So that's fun. And I talk to persuasion pros and people who are doing interesting things and have social issues. And how are they getting those things out? What are their strategies? That would be today's guest. She's a persuasion pro, and she has an entrepreneurial business and a background in education and does all sorts of interesting things. And we have talked before, so this is going to be a revisit, but the other time I've redone this, it's been even better just because I know some things about these humans now. This is Adina Lavelle.
Adina, well, it used to be Laver and now it is Tovell.
Tovell. I made some kind of amalgamation of, that's funny. It's sitting there right in front of me that says Lavelle. So Tovell, and she's the founder of Courageous Curiosity, which is a training, it's a program, it's courses. Do you have a book?
We do not have a book yet, soon.
But you will have a book. She has all the things. Welcome, Adina.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here. And I love the idea that we're talking about rhetoric and words, which I find fascinatingly interesting for so many reasons. So it is a real pleasure to be here.
You know, it's fascinating. I've talked to a lot of people, like we have a co-friend, Christine Kiesinger, Dr. Kiesinger, who I went to grad school with and has a communication studies degree, but from an interpersonal approach. And she's integrated a lot of the communication studies things into healing arts and mysticism and all sorts of cool stuff. And when I contrast myself with her, like rhetoric, hardcore rationalist, I'm a mechanic of talk. Like I don't really care about what seeps in inside and the internal universe and world of people. I care about strongly influencing their behaviors mostly, but their beliefs and their thoughts. But that's what rhetoric pushes you towards, is being a mechanical view of the world. But you guys come from it a very different way. I think you see the technology of language being very useful, but it's kind of a means to an end, right? You're trying to get somebody into a belief state or a different orientation to the world.
It's true. And I actually think that there may be more related in the mechanical and this other view that you're saying, because if we're trying to influence people's idea, people's belief systems, that understanding how language helps to seep in, how the language shapes that belief, how that language brings that, just that sense of doubt or openness to conversion, as you talked about in your introduction, that it's that really powerful tool. And so how does it seep into influence our lives versus how does it seep into influence our politics? Maybe that's the difference.
Yeah. And it's all integrated. You have to use a lot of different tools to get to where you want to go, no matter what you're working in. Sometimes you don't think about them consciously. I was talking to somebody earlier and she comes from a very amalgamated cultural background. She was born in Haiti, raised in Switzerland, taught German and French, and now she's in Vancouver working in the industrial industry with a bunch of men. And she talked about constantly watching her mom, who was Haitian in Switzerland, adjust, and how she's learned how to adjust. So every time she goes to a new culture, you develop these strategies and techniques. You don't think about it in that way. It's an informal set of theories, whereas rhetoric is a very formalized set of theories, but it's all the same thing of trying to get somewhere in the world and get people to agree with your perspective on the world.
And I think to be able to make those connections, because exactly what you're describing with this woman from Haiti is anytime I'm working with a group or an individual, there's always this seeking to match what is their style, what is their belief system, what language do they latch onto, because we'll be most persuasive and best able to connect and best able to influence the more we can match and align to that.
So let's go back. So again, I don't want to assume so much of everybody because I've already talked to you once. Orient people a little bit to what you do and what your program is and your you know, way in the world.
So the company is called Courage to be Curious, and it is a coaching and consulting company. So we do coaching with individuals, we do leadership development coaching, and it really focuses in that respect on the aligning of our beliefs, as we've been just talking about, to what we want to have expressed in the world. So whether that's personally in someone's life or it's in the workplace, one of the things that we work with on leaders is sometimes their leadership, their style of leadership is not at all aligned with who they are in the rest of the world. They just don't have another leadership paradigm. And so we work on shifting that. Or they want to really have impact and be able to support and influence people, but the language that they're using or the ways that they're connecting are not facilitating that. So we're a coaching consulting company. We do the coaching. Consulting, the area that we work in is really in this area of inclusion and belonging. And we look at belonging as, right, how do you influence? Somebody has to feel like they belong somewhere. They have to feel like they matter. In order for there to be a strong connection, for there to be positive influence. So we work on the corporate side, we work on the individual side. We have a podcast also, Courage to be Curious with Adina Tovell, where our goal is to help people wonder their way to brilliant through the use of powerful questions. And so we really look at all the anatomy and opportunities to use questions to shape and design our leadership, our lives, and our influence in the world.
So your rhetorical tools are questions.
They are.
So give me an example of a highly effective question tool that you use.
So one effective question tool that I really like is when somebody says to me, you know, I'm really struggling and I can't do this, or I don't seem to be effective at this, or I'm not getting the results that I want. So they're very focused on the can't and what they're not getting. And I will say to them, and it feels like magic every single time I ask this question, which is why I love it. And I'll say to them, well, when was a time you were ever effective at that? Because when they've been telling me their woes, they're in this space of, I'm just a failure, it doesn't work, you know, all of those things. And as soon as I ask the question, it's like having a key to a magic door inside. When was a time that you were? And immediately, I've never had it fail. They're always able to find a time. And then it just sort of opens up because the opportunity to apply that. So that's one of my magic questions that I really like a lot. We've got a tool belt of magic questions, but that's one of the ones I really love.
Yeah. And I think that is where things like rhetoric, you know, dovetail with what you're talking about is magic tools, is that you either through practice or through some type of theory or learning or like, hey, I wonder if this will work. And you try it with people and you see over and over again, it has this type of success with people because it ties into something psychological or, you know, it brings things together that makes sense to people enough to where they can get to that perspective that you want. So it's great to have those tools, right? To walk around with that tool belt and be like, eh, I'll just pull out this one and see how this works right now. And
yeah, there's also this piece, like you were talking about the mechanics, because one of the things that we do talk about is the mechanics of questions, because there is an anatomy to a question as well. And, you know, how does that work? The word, the interrogative that comes at the beginning, are you asking a why question, a when, a how might, a where, you know, how are you structuring the beginning of the question has a lot of influence in what happens for the person on the other side. One of the things, I mean, it's kind of widely taught out there now is to maybe avoid more of the why questions. And having been an educator, I sort of love to talk about this, is that in school, you give an answer. And if you give the right answer, teachers had a habit of like nodding and saying yes and great and good job. And if you gave an answer that was wrong, it was like, well, why do you think that? And so you only got the why. And that was your clue that you had just screwed up, right? And we've been conditioned about that for a long time. Because we have a bias. And this happens even when we're out in the world, whether we're with friends or in the workplace, we have a bias for what we think we want to hear. We have a bias if we're in the workplace and we're putting, you know, we're sharing ideas or we're in a meeting of what we think we want to hear. And we love getting confirmation. And when we do, we're like, yeah, 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 right? We're all excited. And when we don't get that, you know, whether we feel judged or we're kind of skeptical or whatever it is. And so when we structure the questions, there's this anatomy of how do you structure it that is actually going to open things up or move something forward or remove a defensiveness in the way that you ask it.
Yeah, I think, have you ever taken any type of interview training, like any question training specifically?
I actually do interview training and question training, but I've never actually taken any.
Well, you know, you don't need to, you know, when you know it, right?
I will say, I'm actually, Dan, I want to mention this. I want to do a shout out. Actually, both of the authors of this are going to be on my podcast shortly. And since we talked the last time, I was introduced to this book. It's called Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter by Will Wise and Chad Littlefield. And, you know, I wrote to them to invite them onto the show and said, basically, all right, you wrote my book, so now you have to come onto my podcast show.
That's great. Yeah.
But what they do in here that is so absolutely brilliant is they really do. They break down the mechanics of how we go about constructing questions, what the power questions is, what it can achieve, but also how people will react to different structures of questions, timing of questions. You know, it's one of the most broken down, detailed books I've ever seen on how to do this really well. And, you know, this is the kind of work that we teach. And I was like, so when you asked me about a book, it was like, okay, I don't have to write this one because they already did. So now I can go on to plan B.
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about communication experts. And I don't know if those guys are come from communication background or not, but they break down all the micros in things. So the Socratic method, you know, is a question system, again, from the Greeks 2,500 years ago. Like when you're doing philosophical argument, it's better to not contradict people and do confrontation. It's better to keep them involved by asking them more questions. And there's an art to doing Socratic method. And there are schools that are built completely around that as an educational model where they never tell you you're wrong. You know, they never tell you you're right really either, but the questions keep the process going. And that's an educational tool in that setting. In stuff like sales, you'll get things like motivated interviewing where, you know, it's a design structure to keep people moving towards a yes. And so questions can be adapted across situations like that, but it is very specific rhetoric tools, like it, and it's done very micro ways. When I was in, part of my degree was in cultural studies, which uses ethnography and autoethnography and deep cultural immersion to study, you know, cultures. And there's tons of techniques within ethnography for asking questions. Like a lot of times they'll show pictures instead of asking verbally, like, well, tell me about this picture. And if you do that for people, like show them their photo album or things like that, they tell these deep, intricate stories. But if you just ask them, well, tell me about your father, they can't do it.
Right, right. Absolutely. Different tools for unlocking what's going on in the mind and in the heart, and visual prompts, the structures of your questions, sometimes music, right? Any of those kinds of things that can open up, and all different tools for opening access. I think one of the things that also is really important in the work that we do is, and you touched on this, you know, you just said, what's the motivation for asking the questions, right? Am I a salesperson trying to move you to a yes? Or am I trying to connect and understand you better because we're on a date? Or, you know, what's the purpose of it? Are we in a development conversation at work and I'm trying to understand what went wrong in the project? Or, and this what's the disposition and the motivation behind the asking of the question and really being intentional about that? And so for us, really thinking about the platform of curiosity and curiosity as having this desire to know and understand something without a preconceived notion being at play, which is actually really, really hard. I mean, the first time you and I talked, you asked me to define curiosity. And it was like, yeah, the desire to know and understand something. But it's actually the hard part of it is that if we are genuinely in a disposition or state of curiosity, we're not allowing our anticipation of what we thought what the answer is going to be or what we expect to have happen or a judgment about it to come into play. And for me, that's the really hard part, but where things really get going is, you know, not if I'm trying to get you to a yes. Actually, even if I am trying to get you to get to a yes, I would say curiosity has been one of my greatest tools for like getting, you know, new clients, right? Just let me just be really genuinely curious about you. And then you know, people want to do that work. But when we're trying to be in relationship with other people, assuming that stance, which is a really hard thing to do, is so important because of what it conveys to the other person. You know, our questions and our disposition behind the questions convey either you really matter and I'm interested in you, or this is just functional and I'm checking my box off the list, you know, or I really, I'm not very interested in you. I just want you to hear what I have to say.
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you get into these situations, no matter what the actual framework around it is, like dating, right? Or business, or doing some type of healing with somebody, or doing therapeutic listening, like within your family and all these different things, educational listening, all these different things that you can use listening and questions for, that you start to adapt these sort of big tools, these strategies and tactics down to those situations. And you realize, like, once you have that orientation, like if you just turn your own curiosity loose, it will drive the technique. Like you have the techniques and you're always adapting them. You're always making changes as you go, but the techniques get basically, you know, charged and enlivened by the actual emotion that you're in. And when people learn acting, one of the first things they learn is it's not faking emotion. You have to feel emotion in order to convey emotion. So like even doing these podcast interviews, I'm, you know, sincerely interested in the people I have on here. Like there's only been one guy when I kind of wanted to go after him a little bit. I wasn't really interested in him. I kind of was, but he was an authentic sales kind of guy. It's fun anyway, but I pick people that I'm authentically interested in because it drives the energy and the technique and everything else and keeps it from being a dry mechanic and brings it to life in a human connection.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, you know, you were talking about people, so we have the tools and I work with a lot of people who, you know, I think you do, you're an actor, you are a writer, you are skilled, you have, you know, so much education. What I find is curiosity on the one hand was the most natural thing we were born with, right? We came out with it. But I'm an educator initially by training too. And I, you know, feel really strongly that our education system almost like pounded out every last bit of natural curiosity that we maybe were born with, which we see because the average person, the average child would ask 100 questions a day and then, or more, that's it was an average. And then by the time we're like 14, 15 years old, it falls off a cliff to like under 20. And I think adults, aside from really functional questions, ask almost no curious questions at all. And that it's a tool that actually has to be retrained, you know, a way of thinking that needs to be redeveloped and reignited for many people, because even though it was natural and innate when we were born, we've lost it. And, you know, you and being in comedy, I mean, comedians have to be among the most curious people in the world, right? You're observing the world through this incredibly curious lens and then curating it into this material that helps to bring it back out to people in ways that are going to be intriguing, creative, but also hit really close to home that everybody can see themselves reflected in it. And that many people's lives are structured in a way that curiosity is not part of that what's happening naturally all the time. And so, you know, a lot of what we do is to reignite that, because I think it is what makes connections and relationships stronger. It makes us have a different experience in the world.
How does that work with corporations? Do they at first, like if you bring up curiosity, there's a whole set of tools and emotions that they label as soft, right? The soft skills and that kind of stuff. Do they see curiosity at first as too soft? Like, do you have some people who hesitate to bring that in because it sounds too touchy-feely? Even though now that you're talking about it, clearly there's some real meat to this. There's some real, you know, clear mechanics to it, clear outcomes, clear value. But I would imagine, like, anytime, I know I see this a lot with Christine, you know, she does Reiki and everything else. And as soon as you mention any of that, people are like, oh, I don't know what to do with that. So it's like, is curiosity doesn't seem like a super soft word, but I assume that a lot of corporates see it that way.
So actually, I think things are changing a lot. I think I would have said I agree with that. And maybe even pre-pandemic, we would have, you know, I would have felt more strongly about that. Certainly what happened with George Floyd in the country has kind of skyrocketed diversity, equity, and inclusion to the top of the radar screen of everybody's, you know, or top of everybody's radar screen. And then also with COVID, and all the mental health issues that have come in, and suddenly recognizing we need to pay attention to our people as much as we need to pay attention to the bottom line, maybe even more so. And so I think that there is actually a very heightened level of interest right now in how do we get better at connecting with our people, helping them feel safe, have psychological safety where they are, emotional safety where they are, of having them feel engaged and as though they mattered as people are working more remotely. It's a big question. Engagement is a totally different thing now, right? If we're not all in the office, but people are scattered all over the place, and we know that that's going to continue, that many people are going to remain remote. And so how do we connect with our people? How do we make sure that they are well, you know, and feel emotionally supported, and that they're feeling as though they're making their best contribution? So I think there is a really heightened sensitivity to that and interest in how do we go about creating cultures of inclusivity and belonging, creating cultures of where people feel valued and as though they mattered. So I'm finding now, almost to my surprise, for the reasons that you said, that there is a lot of interest in this kind of work right now.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? I think one of the tenets that you'll hear a lot in big cultural societal change in rhetoric is that it takes a trauma. It takes some type of mass tragedy to get mass change. So like the Civil Rights Act didn't pass until Kennedy was assassinated and MLK and, you know, all these major traumas that everybody experienced at the same time. Then you can get big societal shift, even like the pandemic. And like you said, like suddenly forced onto Zoom and all this alienation, all this fear and anxiety, you know, it's supposedly going to abate now that we're getting vaccinated and people are, but you're still seeing this wave after wave of it. So I can see why that would play very well into that idea of, hey, this isn't going away. This is what we're dealing with right now as a culture. You need new skills and to pay attention to this stuff.
Yeah, we definitely need new skills. And I think I've been pleasantly surprised as I've been talking to people in human resources or training and development or inclusion, diversity, equity, and inclusion departments, that it's no longer like you're trying to, as you said, sell the fluffy stuff. It's like this has become the primary interest, you know, that recognizing diversity and equity, okay, that because it was so politicized, you know, we have to have it on our radar screen. So there was a little bit of have to. But the companies that I'm talking to, it's like they've checked a lot of the boxes, right? Okay, people have been, we need to have diversity and equity. We need to have these basic trainings. But those trainings that everybody's taking and sort of saying, okay, we've got this understanding, we've got that understanding, are also realizing it's not sufficient because it's not giving us the human connection skills. Like maybe we can diversify our workforce and have this number of more people from these diverse groups. And maybe we have to have policies in place to make sure everybody gets equal opportunity for advancement. But belonging is not something you can measure with numbers. Belonging is why people stay. And unlike as you and I know in the past where people would join a company and stay for 25 or 30 years, that's not happening. Like you're lucky to get 3 years, right? Right. You know, in this culture. So the focus on having people feel like they belong someplace and they feel valued there and that they have voice is so much more important. And I think people, companies rightfully so, are paying so much more attention. How do leaders lead? How do they communicate? How do they connect with people and how do they help people to feel valued?
It's fascinating to see this stuff start to filter its way back into corporations now, because being an educator for 20 years in college, you would think college sort of has moved things up to where it's mostly just information transfer, right? Like it goes up to a meta level where it's not like kindergarten where you're helping them with their basic life, you know, skills and daily physical stuff because they can't do it. You know, slowly as you move up through education, you become more and more distanced from your students, like, you know, as human beings. And in college, you're like, okay, I'm just here to give you information and you know, I'll evaluate how well you absorb it. But it always fascinated me, like how people would import all the teacher stuff. And you're supposed to care about the students and there's a connection and all that rhetoric, you know, and training that they brought from these other earlier dimensions of education got imported even into college. You know, you had to act like you care. Not that I didn't.
Well, Dan, now that care, you brought it up, now that
but,
you brought it up.
You know, I wasn't.
Well, I will say this, having a daughter in college, right? She's at University of Vermont, one of my daughters in college. And we've recently had this conversation because I grew up in education too, not in higher education, but in K-12. And, you know, we've often talked about some of the classes that she's taking and then what are the issues that kids on campus are really facing. And I've often said to her, if I were going to design a college curriculum right now, like I want there to be a financial literacy. I want there to be self-defense. I want there to be, you know, kind of how do I manage our money? How do we communicate effectively with people about our needs? Like they are the life skills, but as you're saying, okay, maybe we had them in kindergarten. Well, I'll tell you, No Child Left Behind kind of got rid of that over, you know, about 20 years ago too. So there's almost no place that we get those training in the skills that are for life. And so, and at college, the things that students are facing between the, you know, spread of students who are taking their lives, the addictions, the bullying, the physical assaults, I mean, these are really, really major issues, not to mention the fact that many students just never spend a lot of time away from home, you know, and the traumas that they incur. So maybe societally, we're looking at of having to shift back. And I work with a young woman actually, who was just in Denmark on a study abroad program. When she listens to this, she's going to be like chuckling right now, but they are a country who prioritized happiness and well-being. Right? So they literally, and this permeates through everything. So they are a social system. All of your basic needs are met. So your childcare is met and your aging and your healthcare and all those things are met. And they actually frown on a work week that goes above 35 or 37 hours a week. And it's almost like if you can't get your work done in that amount of time, what's wrong? Because you're supposed to have balance between life and work. And when they've done these happiness studies globally, that they're at the top of the list because they recognize that it's actually humans that live in their country and not robots that live in their country. And, you know, did the due diligence of getting curious and looking if we wanted to have a happy, healthy population, how would we structure things? And we haven't asked those same questions here. No. I wonder if we're even fully aware of what questions we've asked to arrive at the structures that we have.
No, I think that's a great question. There's again, you asking questions. Yeah.
Well,
that is right. Like you're asking a national level question. You're asking America a question. Have you really thought about what what our priority is. Like, do we have a national priority? You know, if you look at the Constitution, it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's not happiness. That's chasing happiness. And they give you plenty of opportunity to chase it. There's not a guarantee that you'll catch it. Yeah. Denmark sounds like they're more interested in helping you catch it.
I love that, actually, that distinction. And I hadn't thought about the language of it that way, the pursuit of happiness, which goes to the importance of the language that we choose and the language that we use is we put a word in there of pursuit. Well, we got a lot of people pursuing, you know, we've tied it to finances and money in lots of ways, but there's never that catching. And that is the struggle and the suffering that most people in America are up against.
Yeah. And look at how many people catch the American dream. You know, they have the house, they have some money, they have stability and all these things, and they still don't have happiness, like, because it's not in that package. You know, it's not in the American package of what that actually means. You see it come back up. And I think this is sometimes when I see corporate wellness and that kind of work, I'm like, yeah, because we've ignored that in the other areas. You know, the churches try to make up for it and education is kind of forced to make up for it, but really it's a societal gap. Maybe if the Constitution is that we guarantee you'll be happy.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting because that question that I just posed at the national level, right? Have we really thought about what question is driving us, our choices and our priorities, is the same question I ask personally. And I remember asking it of myself, and it came up around this happiness thing. Since we're talking about this, I was in my coach training program, like, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. And there was a small little exercise that said, list three things that make you happy. And I couldn't answer it. I was like, it was one of these moments of paralysis. I'm the daughter of an immigrant who did a really good job of chasing, you know, the American dream, which was more financial than happy based. And I just really, happiness wasn't in our vocabulary at home, and it was just structured around other things. And for me, it was even tied to things like hobbies and what do you like? And I never, ever could answer those questions. And I was sweating and I was doing all these things. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here. I got to get out of the room. But anyway, I decided in that moment, I want to know what the answer to that question is. Like, I want to know what are things that actually drive my own happiness, because I had no idea if actually happiness felt like one of those foreign words. And so what I did is I took up the pursuit of a question I actually talked about in a recent podcast, which was, if my goal was to experience happiness, what would I choose in this very moment? And so I wanted to take it into a really narrow context. So in this moment, when somebody says, what do you want for dinner? In this moment, when I have some free time. And doing this process was really successful over time. And I was able to suddenly kind of construct what happiness was for me. But then what I pursued became even more interesting. I asked myself, well, if your life has not really been designed around happiness, what has it been the response to? What has been the meta question that has driven the organization and the choices in your life? And when I posed that question and I kind of sat and I made a whole list of big choices that I've made and big decisions, and I said, well, what was underneath that? What was behind that? I came back to the fact that the organizing question behind my life was, what do I need to do to be approved of? What was interesting is not necessarily the question. I think many people could say that resonates with me, but I think what was interesting was it was totally unconscious. And we have these unconscious questions that are driving our behaviors, our choices, our reactions all the time, whether we're the leader of a Fortune 500 or we are somebody, you know, taking care of our kids, or we are running a shop or a bakery or whatever it is. The subconscious is so powerful, and we always are, everything we say, do, and feel is a response to some question that has been kind of wired into our subconscious. And so when I talk about working with people around questions, most of my questions revolve around questions that drive reflection. How do we do that thing of knowing and understanding the operating system that's built into us so that we can have the operating system work for us and actually operate the way that it will bring us what we want?
It's So you're helping people map their inner operating software.
Yes. And make adjustments when they feel that that would be well serving or serve them well.
Yeah. So the computer reaches back into its own self and changes its programming.
And people often ask me, like almost every time I have a client, you know, once I explain to them a little bit of the neuroscience of how humans work and things like that, they say, well, how do you do it? And I say, well, that's what I'm going to teach you. Questions become, but we have to be curious. We have to be willing to be curious. We have to know how to decipher that operating system. And questions is the most powerful tool I have and that I know of to do that inquiry.
Yeah. As you talk about this, like, again, my thing in rhetoric is to sort of lay out these tools to make them useful for people. So to take this 2,500 year study of rhetoric, often very esoteric, you know, linguistic philosophy and things like that, and harvest it so that you can bring it back as software that people can maybe integrate into their lives. And one of them is I created the system, like no matter what you're doing, you're either trying to get people to think, feel, do, or be something. Like as a rhetorician, when you're trying to affect people, think, feel, do, be. And so like it really comes down into like when I try to do change, like think, you're, like questions still keep you in think. They're a cognitive tool, right? You've got to let that go through your mind. You got to sift and sort and look and make choices and evaluations. And they trigger emotions. But one of the easiest ways to do it, I've found, like when I do conversions as opposed to like direct cognitive change, which is argument and things like that, is just put people in the experience, in the new experience. No matter whether they, you know, want to, or they think about it or whatever, it will act backwards. So like when I got into stand-up, I always enjoyed public performance, but I'd never done anything like that other than sort of teach a little bit in college. And I just remember walking towards the stage going, I am totally untrained, unready. Nobody's ever, here I go. And, you know, I was suddenly on stage for the first time in my life for 5 minutes. And it was just such an infusion of experience. It changed everything just in that 5 minutes. Like it literally reoriented me. I've done it for 40 years now. It was that right. Powerful.
It absolutely is, because what's happening, and you're exactly right, change at the operating system level doesn't happen if we just stay in our head about something, because the memory of how we do things or how we feel about things is stored in every cell in the body and in the nervous system. So it has to be, change has to happen as a full embodied experience. And so, you know, I love this description that you're giving is, I could sit, I could think, I could plan, I could worry, I could strategize, I could do all of that stuff. But until that moment when you actually step forward there and it becomes a full embodied experience, you haven't shifted. And, you know, so, it, you know, in the coaching that we do, there's a number of tools that get to that in other ways, because if you just stay in your head, it'll just be kind of, you know, interesting exploration, but no actual movement.
Give me an example of one of those, like you're talking about exercises that you designed to get people into this stuff sort of in a not completely artificial way, but in a safe, kind of quick, accessible way.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll share two of them. One of them is, you know, much, I guess, more simple to explain, but, you know, it's one of the reasons even in coaching, you do a lot of role play. Like you had to get up in front of there and you had to do that. And so I learned early on in my coaching practice that, okay, we could talk about things and they could say yes, and they demonstrate or make it seem as though they understood and got it and were energized to go, and then wouldn't actually follow through with the thing that we talked about. And I realized because they hadn't taken that step, they hadn't embodied it in order to own it. So I do a lot of role play. I almost feel like we're on stage. As you know, I'll say, okay, brief me on who the other character in the scene is. And we right. actually, I mean, in your language, we would do scene work, right? Where we actually practice the scene back and forth. And I keep pushing them and keep pushing them a lot like a director would in order to get it to where I can feel that they can feel it. Right. So we would call it role play. We would call it scene work. It's very much, we do that until I can feel that they have claimed it fully inside, right? So that's definitely one of the tools that we use in a full group experience. I often have people build things, right? And they build things with their hands and they construct them, models for things that they want to have or models that they're using in terms of human forms. But if you ask somebody to build a model of that represents an experience that they want to have, there's a whole other piece of them that has to go into that. And so that tactile piece. The third thing that I can mention, you know, here that I've done a lot of work with, and there are a number of processes in the therapy world that are related to this, whether it's EMDR, which is meant for releasing trauma, or hypnosis or things like that. Each of these different techniques is aimed at shifting how the subconscious is experiencing something. And so I have a particular tool that I use, but here's like the magic of it. When I engage with somebody, there's the conscious mind, the thinking mind, the one we're using to talk right now, which only represents about 3 to 5% of what's happening in our active world at any given time. It's like the iceberg effect, 10% above the water, 90%, except this is only 3 to 5% above, you know, is in the conscious world. And 95 to 97% of everything that we are thinking, doing, feeling, every movement that we are making is being driven by the subconscious mind. And when I approach people, we approach them as though the subconscious is actually a breathing independent entity that they can have a relationship and that we can communicate with, because it actually is. In the beginning, it's kind of weird because they don't know the separation, but the separation is you're telling me yes, yes, yes. Everything about your body is telling me no, no, no. So I know that the subconscious has a different idea than your conscious mind has right now. So there's this, you know, technique that I use where I start to be able to dialogue with their subconscious mind to get permission. And is the subconscious mind, as though the subconscious, because I believe it is its own entity. And using muscle testing techniques that chiropractors have been using for forever or to communicate with the body is developing and establishing a relationship. I know this is one of those things like Reiki that's going to sound like off the chart.
I'm open to. I've talked to shaman who are inhabited by 14th century witches before, so I'm into all of it. I think it's fun.
Yeah. And I do think of it a lot like that computer we were talking about before, is that you have the hardware, you have the software, and then we have like the keyboard and the parts we see externally. So we operate at the keyboard level, right? Which is like the smallest fraction of capability of the computer. It's all this software underneath it that's making it work, and then the hardware that's holding it together. And the hardware is like our body, right? You know, if we're in a lot of pain, something's not going to work right or whatever. But the subconscious is like the operating system. And if your computer were not doing what you wanted it to do, you'd have to take to somebody and they would determine, is this a hardware issue or is it a software issue? And so the subconscious is in charge of the software. I mean, it is the software. So this was actually based on the work of a psychiatrist who really determined and established that the subconscious is like its own independent entity, has total capability for healing. And so if somebody has a deep belief system, can use this work for dialoguing with the subconscious to really see where the blocks are and how to shift it.
So again, from Mr. Hyper-rationalist language storms, entire language worlds, it's very interesting to listen to people once they get into their wheelhouse for what they've chosen, you know, the trainings they've chosen and the insights they've chosen and the tools that they want to use and offer people. And so I was married to a therapist for 10 years. And so I've heard lots of her stuff, which was mostly cognitive behavioral therapy. And she did couples counseling. So like the idea of the subconscious, right, is a construct. I think Freud is the one at least popularized it. Did he invent it? I don't know, but it's a rhetoric construction, not that it isn't accurate or useful or anything else, but it's definitely constructed out of language that once you start listening to somebody's approach, you know, their very strong worldview, you start adopting all their sort of language worlds. And so the idea that there's a subconscious and you can get in connection with it and you can heal in there and it's 95%, all that stuff is, it's very interesting and very powerful. as a comedian, like I have a show called Revenge of the Marriage Counselor's Ex-Husband. And it's essentially, yes, I get it. Therapy, man, huge world. So many different approaches and so much healing and strong theory over there. Comedy is also a really strong world. So this happened because I made a joke once. We were going to couples counseling ourselves before we got divorced. And I was like, you know, it's really serious in there. This is a drama. This is for drama people. And she was more of a dramatist. And so I'm like, you know, we should balance it. Every other week we should go see a comedian and talk about our relationship. I've got some friends that we could just go, and I'd love to hear their perspective on why you do what you do and I do what I do. And she didn't laugh, but I did. And I'm like, I'm going to do that someday. I'm going to create that. And it's this idea of how do you, like, if I was coming at it that from a rhetorician, it's one perspective, a comedian, it's another perspective. If it's somebody that's, you know, like a healer or therapeutic, then it's just fascinating. I mean, you're bringing really cool stuff that I can imagine people really get value out of, but you have to bring them into that world, right?
You do. And that's like, if we look at language, is the use of metaphor is really helpful, right? Because you can have these really complex. And so comedians take a really complicated, you know, kind of intricate world, and they make it totally accessible through humor, right? And then it just comes right out, it spills right out, and everybody can identify. So you have your ways of taking these constructs and then bringing them forward. And, you know, so in my world, one of the tools I've discovered is metaphor, is take anything that might seem the least bit esoteric. Sometimes people are really into science, so then go for it and use the scientific terms. So if I'm working with doctors or nurses, I put all the biology terms to it and everything like that, and they love it. But if I'm talking to other people who that's not their jam, then okay, what is the metaphor that's going to work for them? Because language is how we make sense of the world, right? Language is how we affect impact, which is, you know, what all of this conversation is about. So I think even as a coach or in a consultant and working with people, is maybe we sometimes overlook, like, we get can get so mired in what's the language of my field that we forget to adapt the way that we're presenting the knowledge to the person so that it's actually totally receivable. Because it's interesting, I have a colleague and she's a therapist as well, and we use some similar techniques. But one of the things she realized, she said, I've been kind of overlooking the degree to which I need to make sure that they buy in to the tool I'm using. Because if they don't buy in, like, there's no magic wands out there.
Right.
The way that you affect belief and subconscious comes because somebody buys in and believes that.
Because you're persuasive.
Yes, because you're persuasive. But language, as you, this is your whole podcast is about, language is the tool that we have to persuade. So when we're dialoguing with anyone, and this is like what we work with leaders too. If you have six different people you supervise, you can't come with the same dialogue to each of them because they all speak different languages. And so you need different ways to convey what you have to say that will become meaningful to them. And so with the subconscious stuff, it's the same thing. It's like, okay, which client do I have in front of me? Which is the way in to help gain their buy-in? Because when they have buy-in, they're going to get the most benefit.
It's a lot of work coaching. You've got to do so much adaptation, you know, so that you, like, that work of translating all the stuff you know and that you've studied and that you like down to a new human being each time. And you see the things that aren't working and you see the, you know, language adjustments. And people get this when they talk to little kids, like when suddenly you have to take a kid through a complex topic or something, you know, you're like, oh my God. And you can feel that communication challenge. Like, I was watching a movie the other night, this horrible movie with Casey Affleck that I think he wrote and directed, which is a bad idea for an actor because they keep the camera on themselves forever. But he was talking to his daughter in this dystopian movie. And he's like, one of the things he trained her to is like, listen to your inner warnings. If you, your inner voice, when it starts to tell you something's weird, don't talk yourself out of it, listen to it and get out of there. And she made, you know, he must've said it to her 10 times during the movie, you know, your inner voice, what's true here. It's real. It's authentic. It's trustable. And so he was training her to that. you know, and to get that to where a kid can understand it, you know, repetition, simplification, taking it over to a metaphor, you know, so if Barney the dinosaur tells you, you know, to leave, then you should leave. So there's so much work in coaching. It wears me out when I coach.
For me, I think it's, you know, one of those things that we're all designed and suited for certain things. For me, it's like my flow. It's what comes most naturally to me. But I love the example. Like, I was thinking as you were talking about the inner voice, I wasn't exactly sure where you were going to go, but I've had people, right? You get a five different people and he wants to train them in this thing, right? And he uses the inner voice messaging for all of them. And maybe there's one person in that crowd that the inner voice, that all they can think of is some horror movie that they watched where the inner voice was like this thing that was planted in them and attacking, right? And suddenly you say inner voice and they've shifted into, oh my God, you want me to listen to the thing that's supposed to be destroying me? They're not getting the message you're conveying. They're getting something that is resulting from something you have no idea about because it's hidden, right? What's going on in that subconscious long-term memory is hidden. And that's where, you know, as rhetoricians, as people who are aiming to influence, yes, it is so much that you have to pay attention to, because if I've used language and I'm getting a response from that language that's totally different from what I expected, I have to shift. And that's why, like, I keep coming back to it, the curiosity. Like, if I just stay curious, if I can teach people to stay curious, then we can make the adjustments. If I'm too attached to the way I'm doing it, or I have to get it done quickly, or I have to get this across, or I have to make this happen. Like, our attachment to what we have to have as the outcome is the curiosity killer, and then therefore the influence and impact killer.
Yeah, I think all that's very true. And I find, you know, with good persuaders, they are hyper interested in their targets. Like, it's not about, everybody looks at persuasion as this kind of win-lose, I'm manipulating somebody, you know, I'm doing this for my self-interest, not theirs. And that's not really the powerful persuasion. That's not successful persuasion, because it has to be win, 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 win. Otherwise, when the person loses, they're going to be like, oh, I lost. I don't like you. I'm going to come back and find a way to get back at this. And if you're making enemies with your persuasion, then you are not winning. You're setting yourself for big losses. And this is part of the thing with our politics right now. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, you can get votes, but man, you're making people hate you right and left, and that will come back. And it does. And so I think when you look at that stuff about moving people through things and, you know, still taking care of them as you do that, it is fascinating to watch across industries and occupations and coaching and healing and straight up instruction. It's always the same kind of dynamic. Like, is this self benefit? Is this other benefit? Is this our benefit? You know?
And to come back full circle, when you sort of were talking about the college campus and it's my job to fill them with knowledge, right? It's not that easy, because if I've got 50 people in my lecture, the way that I present it is not going to be received equally by 50 people or in the same way. Do I care about the conveying or do I care about the receiving? You know, which is actually my goal? And if we haven't asked that question, right? If we haven't become aware of which question we're actually answering through our actions, we might be, you know, resulting something we never intended. And so I've always been fascinated where professors are sometimes dumbfounded by how poorly students do on a test or something like that. And I wonder, well, were you not paying any attention along the way? Because, you know, if you're curious and paying attention, not only to what you're conveying, but what the receiving is, you probably would have included into the fact that your students had no idea what you're talking about.
That's a tough dynamic though, because the value and the enjoyment as a intellectual getting paid, you know, for your thoughts and the things that you've developed is just communicate it in the way you want to communicate it. You know, this is the way I think and how I feel and my examples. And that's different than a teacher, like with the educator, the idea of I'm here to adapt things so that you can ingest them and feel them and get to things. So in some ways I totally get it. I had an instance once where I started a new grad school, my PhD program, and it was a brand new PhD program. And so there's a lot of people there, master's students who hadn't really been in a I'd come from UT Austin, which is a high powered educational environment, you know, take no quarter and give no quarter and take no prisoners, keep up or don't you know, we'll leave you behind. We don't care. And they were much more caring and like, you know, we'll take you, we'll help you through stuff. And I raised my hand finally. I was like, is this grad school? Like, I'm not here to be slowed down by somebody else's learning process. Like, if you're slowing down to help them, that means you are not staying at speed to give me everything I could have gotten. And so it is a widely divergent population. One person, how do you adapt, you know, your messaging, your coaching that much? You know, is that part of the job? And I've always like, I care about people. I was a teacher, so I did some of that. But ultimately, it'd be more fun to just be like, you know what I think?
And as you said, there's room and space for everything, right? Because there are people who are like, yeah, just I want to just show up and give me everything you've got. And I think that's why it's important. And it's interesting. It sounds like the two universities may have asked themselves that question. You know, one of them said, you know, which thing is our priority? And if student educating, learning, reception is the most important thing, we're going to structure this way. If having, you know, our really skillful experts and being leaders and developing knowledge and, you know, putting that knowledge out into the world is our priority, then we're doing the right thing. And then as the student, we need to choose the environment that is best suited to us. I think it's just, are we consciously asking and answering those questions? That's like, you know, the interesting, are we consciously asking and answering?
Well, I think you and I work in the same ways. I tell people when they come on my show and I'm going to do a conversion with them, it's like, I don't care what you believe. I don't care if you're on the right. I don't care if you're on the left. I don't care if you think Dr. Fauci has a, you know, Satan tail and horns underneath, you know, his med stuff, or if you think he's a saint on earth. What I care is the process. I care about how you get to what you believe. I don't care what you believe. If your process, if I see flaws in your process, that's where I'm going to focus. That's where I can be useful. So the beliefs themselves will take care of, they'll take care of themselves if you follow a good process. Just most people haven't been trained to process. And that's kind of what you're bringing. Like even the idea of, hey, let me hold up this golden orb of curiosity. Everybody look at it. Like that's going to be our defining beacon for a while. And that orients everybody emotionally and intellectually and even behaviorally that, you know, and it does give them a certain training, that I think I would clearly see value in, you know, especially in countering our modern culture, which, as you said, breezes right past curiosity. And it's like, get to training and job training. And
one of the things that's always struck me, I mean, I saw it in education. I see it in corporate training and development too, is we've designed them to have so much urgency around them. Right? There's so much urgency to make a change or to get to an outcome, right? So much urgency to reach the test scores or so much urgency to finish this project, to get this done because there's things to move on to. And in that urgency, we tend to not follow processes, right, to the full extent that would benefit. And so we shortcut everything because we're worried about time. What's always interesting to me is although we think that time is what the precious resource is that we're conserving, is that when we don't follow the process, everything typically falls apart on the back end. And then we're doing tons and tons of catch up and trying to rebuild and retrain or redevelop or, you know, reskill and all of those things. But nobody's calculating that as the right cost of the failure to follow the process. We don't calculate it in education. We don't calculate it in the workplace. And if, you know, I love the little phrase, I've been using it a lot, the stitch in time saves nine. But because we're feeling this urgency of time on the front end, we do all these things that really cost us to lose so much time on the back end, and we never make the connection.
Yeah, it goes back to process again, right? Like we're a results-oriented culture. Business is results-oriented. Everybody looks at, you know, who won the game, you know, what was the outcome? And they don't look back at the, you know, massive process leading up to that. That's not as interesting, I think, in American culture, which does lead us to a lot of problems on the back end, you know. And when I bring people, I drag people back into logic. Like one of the things I'm doing right now is creating a logic training, because I realized nobody has training in logic, not the rational people, not the educated people, not the engineers, nobody. They really don't understand. I'm like, you're thinking like pseudo logic. Like, let me take you back through and show you the patterns, which will clean up your arguments before they happen. But we're just not trained to it, because again, we can all think, right? Let's think together and let's get to the end. I'm like, eh, let's slow down and let me whiteboard all this for you so you can see the parts of it that you're skipping.
Well, that's good. I think let's work together here, Dan, to swing the pendulum, right? The pendulum that swung so far over here to whether it's efficiency or fast-pacedness, and like see what we can to swing it back in the other direction, because there'd be so much benefit for us in doing that.
Well, and even as an educator, you know this, like linear learning is a myth. Like it usually is epiphany learning, that you do development, it's messy, and then all of a sudden something just, two synapses just pop together and they get it. And I've always told people when I work with them in creative stuff, they're like, well, how long will this take? And I'm like, meh, I don't know. I've got a process. I know how much time I'm going to spend on it, but you want me to spend my good battery time on it. You don't want me to fake it. And like when I do naming and things like that, which are communication diamonds, right? They're so small and they have to be so strong. I'm like, I take 6 weeks. And they're like, 6 weeks to come up with a name. I'm like, yeah. And I got a process I go through, but they'll check on me. They're like, well, how's it going? I'm like, I don't know. I'm working on it.
You know, it's the stuff that happens in the shower, right? It's like the shower time epiphanies, and you can't really put that on your time log. You know?
Yeah, but the shower epiphanies or the insomnia epiphanies only happen if you've done all the work before.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And you try to tell them that like, oh no, look at these files. I'll build a 50 to 100 page file for one name because I'm doing all this research and putting in all this metaphors and images and whatever. And then it all boils and cooks into a roux and suddenly, oh, look at that perfect bite. So, well, I know you need to go. I appreciate you jumping back on again.
Well, thank you, Dan. No, it's been really great to be here. And I just want to share like a few resources that might be helpful to people as we're closing up. And you know, one of the things we've discovered in the work is that we do a lot of talking about questions, hopefully gotten people really intrigued about the power of questions, the structure of questions, and what questions can do for us. And recognizing that, you know, people don't always have them at their fingertips. So we have constructed three decks of cards: Live with the Courage to be Curious, Love with the Courage to be Curious, and Lead with the Courage to be Curious, that are all designed questions to cultivate both the understanding of how to ask powerful questions, as well as how to practice that reflection. You know, what does it really mean to kind of be intentional in my life, to be impactful as a leader, to show up in a relationship with somebody in a way that is really tuned in and attentive to myself and to them? So we've developed these cards, which are on our website at couragetobecurious.com. And every week we have our podcast. There is always a live episode, a lead episode, a love episode, and then kind of a random conversation with somebody on a monthly theme at Courage to be Curious with Adina Tovell, which is now both on YouTube and on podcast apps, where really we are every week. How do we wonder our way to our brilliant selves? You know, brilliant, not in the academic sense, but brilliant in terms of being our best selves and the best version of ourselves. And so, you know, I just want to share that with people because I think they are great tools for cultivating this skill set and bringing it in to really positively shape life and leadership and relationship.
Yeah. And anybody who's listened to this podcast, you can clearly tell that Adina has a lot to offer. There's a lot of value in this stuff. And again, my hyper-rational, language-oriented philosophy stuff is what I do. But I always think of you, like now I have this image of you holding this golden crystal orb that's floating around, and that's curiosity. And you're telling everybody, hey, look at this. Remember this thing from childhood? It turns out like this is really useful, really valuable, and taking people, you know, down paths to get there and using that to infuse their work and their life and all that kind of stuff. It just seems really cool. So I'm glad you're out there doing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
So go to Adina's website, check out Courage to be Curious, check out the cards, all the podcast stuff. I'm sure there's even more value in there. Thanks again, Adina, for coming back. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. As always, persuade people. It's good for them.